Thank you, and good afternoon. Welcome to the Committee for the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. And I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1 directs employers to provide the day off on Veterans Day or an alternative day to employees who are veterans if certain conditions are met. It permits noncompliance on Veterans Day for significant economic or operational disruption or undue hardship. This bill declares an emergency and will be effective upon passage.
Thank you. So for the first panel, we will call forward Senator Courtney and Senator Olson. You know what to do. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Senator Courtney Scott.
My name is Peter Courtney, and I live in Northeast Salem. I'm a state senator representing District 11, which includes major portions of Salem. It also includes Jervis and Woodburn. In fact, this very building is actually in my district. I think it's very nice. Now, I understand that, so I want to make sure the testimonies being handed out, I didn't insult anybody. I was going to say Chair Matthews, but I assume he's not here today. Is that how that works? So I don't want to disrespect. I understand Vice Chair Fagan and Vice Chair Parrish. Is that correct to indicate those titles? I want to make sure I don't offend anyone here when I say that. And other members of the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. I'm here today to support what has been known as Senate Bill 1. This is the second time I introduced this bill. I introduced it last session, and I'm very grateful today that I would get a hearing today in the House. Back on November 11th, 2010, which was Veterans Day, I was at a place I go to in the morning to get my foo-foo coffee for 99 cents. It's a 76 gas station out here in North Salem. And Lucy's out there, and I sort of know all the people, and they think Peter's sort of old and funny, and she said, Peter, can I ask you a question? I said, oh, sure, Lucy, ask me a question. And she said, why is it Veterans, today's Veterans Day, why don't Veterans Day get Veterans Days off? And I said, I don't know what to say, Lucy. I don't know anything about is that. I don't know if that's true or not. And so when I got back to the state capitol, I immediately looked into it, and sure enough, there is no absolute statement that veterans get Veterans Day off, with the exception of the state of Iowa, we'd find out. Her late husband, had been in the Vietnam War and had been in heavy duty there, to say the least, as she eventually would tell me, and he had eventually, even though the war was long over, he had passed away from those injuries. Her present husband was also a veteran, and neither one of them could get Veterans Day off given the jobs. And so she said to me, what do you think about that? I said, well, I'm going to introduce a bill for you, Lucy, and I'm going to name it after you and your husband's. And she came 2 years ago to testify in front of the Senate committee, and she was terrified. She was just terrified. She was shaking. She brought her husband. She brought her son. And it was a remarkable day, and I think Senator Olson may remember that day. And so she testified. And it's interesting. The bill was very simple as we first read it. And then the chair of the Veterans Committee, Colonel Senator Brian Boquist, asked the good Senator Olson, who's on that committee, we're both on the Veterans Committee, to work at the bill. And he did an extraordinary job with that bill, because immediately ran into problems with the business community, that this bill was a mandate, that it would hurt business, that it would be a burden. And the fact is, this is not a mandate. This is not a mandate. If you read the bill and all the work that Senator Olson has done, as well as what we saw was going on in Iowa, you'll note in there that the requirements for the veterans to come for their employer at a certain period of time, show them their veterans say, I'd like to have the day off. Even then, the employer does not have to give them the veterans day off if the work schedule of the business is such they still need the veteran there. However, it does allow for the employer to pick another day, even whether or not the veteran is paid or not is up to the employer. So it's a very functional bill. We've worked very, very hard on this bill. And I since the situations have developed in Iraq and in Afghanistan in a long time, this legislature has probably led the nation, in my humble opinion, on legislation to show incredible support to veterans and their families. And I just think that this bill makes so much sense to say that on Veterans Day, that's their day, That's their day. We should do as much as we possibly could to be sure that a veteran gets a chance to have that day off. And so even though you have, you know, I don't like to read from my testimony. I always give written testimony to a committee. It's there. I departed from the testimony. But that's the sum and substance of it. I just need to say one last thing. Amazingly, the committee he and I serve on is equal number Democrats and Republicans. It was that way last session. It's that way this session. If you go back and look at the record before the Veterans Committee in the Senate, last session, this session, all members voted for it. And then it came on the Senate floor. There were no votes. Again, when this bill came off the floor just here a week ago, there were no votes. There has yet to be a no vote for this bill in committee or on the state Senate in the two times that we have passed this bill. Totally bipartisan, a bill that had nothing to do with Democrat, Republican, nothing to do with rural, urban. It was an Oregon bill about Oregon veterans. Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish. Members, my name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I will digress a little bit from my own handwritten prepared statement. When I was first elected, as I'm driving to Salem, I got a call on my cell phone, and we could answer our cell phones at that time, and it was the Senator Peter Courtney's office, and he asked me, well, you'd like to be on Veterans Affairs Committee. Would you be interested in supporting a bill that would allow veterans to have Veterans Day off? And I said, the first, my little trite I was, to be honest with you, I said, well, I'd have to read it first. And I read it, and it meant something to me. And I decided that as we looked at it, that it would be a little bit onerous for business. So basically, we were able to put this bill together. And so I'd like you, if you would please, picture a World War II machinist on an LSM in the Pacific Ocean, or a radio operator on a nameless hill in Vietnam. Some will know what that's like. A 20-year-old MP searching for stolen ordnance in Korea. A gunner on a Bradley fighting machine, or fighting vehicle, in the largest tank battle in military history in Desert Storm. Also picture a special forces person, operator, who has gone at a moment's notice to a destination we don't know about. Or a National Guardman who has just returned from his third tour of duty in Afghanistan. These six are my father, three of my closest friends, a colleague, and myself. We are all veterans. Granted by the federal government a great honor, November 11th, Veterans Day. Our day, a day reserved to honor our service. I ask that you support Senate Bill 1. This bill honors all veterans by allowing them to have their day off, November 11th. This bill is not a mandate on employers, as the good president said. They may approve or disapprove the request. If they approve and so wish to honor that veteran employee that they have, they may pay them or allow them to have the day off without pay, their choice. The employer may also allow the veteran to take any other day other than November 11th off if it causes a hardship for the employer, for his business. The employer holds all the cards in this bill. The veteran is the one that's mandated. He must prove he is a veteran by showing his DD-214 or other documentation to prove he's a veteran, and must ask at least 21 days prior to November 11th to have that day off, to give the employer adequate time to prepare for that Veterans Day off. Please remember that all federal, state, and local governments get the day off, along with the post office, along with banks, along with many other agencies, government officials that get the day off. And many of these folks aren't veterans, but yet they are allowed to have Veterans Day off, whereas the veteran who works in the private sector is not. They benefit from the sacrifices that our men and women in uniform have made. Let us honor our servicemen at the state level. Please support Senate Bill 1. I'll be glad to take any questions that you would have.
Thank you both very much. Are there any questions of the panel?
Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm ready to vote. So I think that it should be just mandated in that sense, but that's just me. But one question I have is that, so you tried it before, what happened? If it went through, did it die in the House, or what happened?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish. It went to the House Committee. It was in the House Committee when we signed it, died.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to be very...
You're being very diplomatic, yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to be very diplomatic.
Well, I want to thank you both for doing this. Thank you, Senator Courtney. This is a really important bill.
Madam Chair, if I may. This is the exact same bill we brought forth 2 years ago, and it did pass unanimously in the Senate and came here. It's the exact same bill. There was no change whatsoever. So any verbiage to the contrary of that, I just would like to point out for the record that this is the exact same bill we moved last time.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes things just don't work out, and sometimes there are different motives that's going on in the building, so therefore I'm sorry that this didn't pass last time, but it is what it is. So now we'll come to grips with this and we'll pass it.
Any other questions? I just have one, just kind of regarding the practicality of it for the veterans who might not be listening on the radio right now with bated breath. Mm-hmm. What is the provisions for notice for an employer? Is it going to be on, I mean, is there any provision so that an employer gives veterans who happen to work for them notice that they, A, have the right to ask for this day off, and B, that if they're going to, they need to ask 21 days, you know, I don't, can't do the math in my head, but sometime in mid-October, they need to ask by that period so that we make sure that with the intention of allowing veterans to have their day, that we make sure that all veterans know they have the right to have their day.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, that's an incredible question. There is nothing in the bill that speaks to that. However, it's my understanding one of the people who will speak here, I'm not going to try to set him up, is the head of the Veterans Department. And I think, should this bill move out of this committee successfully and move off the House floor and the governor signs it, I would hope that the Veterans Department would work very hard to make sure that veterans in general were aware of this. But there is an educational component, you're very right, and it's not fair to hold businesses to knowledge of something they won't be held honest to. So we have an educational component to make this work. It is not in the bill. It is not in the bill. So that's an extraordinary question, and I hope that through this public hearing that it'll begin the education process, assuming you in your collective wisdom you support the bill, assuming in the collective wisdom of the House they support the bill, including the governor will sign the bill.
Vice Chair Parrish.
Thank you. So one of the only times I really get a chance to read is when I'm stuck on an airplane, is reading for pleasure, and it was Governing Magazine, though, actually, January's issue, talking about state legislatures across the nation, that one of the top 10 issues we need to be considering in 2013 is our veterans' issues, that should be up there on our criteria, and sometimes that's not. I appreciate you bringing this forward. Actually, my husband had a little heartburn with it when I, as a veteran, because a lot of times our veterans just don't ask for things and they don't want that type of recognition. I think it's important we give it, but I think it's also, you know, one of these bills that doesn't cost us in the legislature to do anything. I think it's important that we continue to have good progress, and I know our partners in the Senate do a really good job about, you know, trying to make sure that our veterans are covered. I will continue to just urge our committee that, you know, the ones that are really easy to move don't cost the legislature any money. That's great. We want to move those things, but I think we also just want to continue to keep the pressure on the fact that we've also got to do some of the bills that spend some money on veterans as well.
Great. Well, I think when I'm on an airplane, I read People Magazine. So let the record reflect that I am very impressed that Vice Chair Parrish reads Governing Magazine on an airplane. So there's nothing further. We'll call up the next panel, which is Cameron Smith and Robert Thornhill.
Do you want to go first, sir?
Let him go first.
If you wish, whatever.
Go for it, sir.
Will do. Thank you. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I appear before you in support of Senate Bill 1. In doing so, I represent District 3 of the Oregon Veterans of Foreign Wars and its 5 Portland VFW posts. I've submitted written testimony. With your permission, I'd like to read a summary of that testimony.
Yes.
Since shortly after the fighting of the First World War ended at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, America has set aside a day each year to honor the men and women who served in uniform for their nation's common good. The first such day, Armistice Day, 11 November 1919, honored the veterans of World War I. In June 1954, following World War II, the bloodiest war of all time, followed then by Korea, Armistice Day became Veterans Day, a national and state holiday in which communities across this land celebrate and honor veterans of all wars for their sacrifices and achievements for the common good. Veterans Day is a paid holiday for the over 2 million federal employees, of whom 26.3%, or 542,641, as of last available report, are veterans. Veterans Day is also a paid holiday for Oregon State employees. I have no idea how many of them are veterans. All Americans have benefited from the sacrifices in military service of veterans. Therefore, we believe it is not asking too much to ask that private sector employees who can afford it voluntarily join government in giving their veteran employees a day off on Veterans Day. SB 1 has been masterfully crafted, providing flexibility to both employer and employee. The business persons of our membership support the bill, as well as non-business persons. And I have been asked in concluding to acknowledge that we know it is the private sector employers and employees who create the wealth that pay the bills for our wars and for the many benefits provided veterans, to include whatever Senate Bill 1 may cost. Without the private sector, it wouldn't be possible. Many veterans, however, are part of that sector. Committee, thank you for holding this hearing and hearing me out. And to all of you, on behalf of my veteran comrades, thank you for what you do here in Salem.
Thank you.
Try to answer any questions you may have.
I think we'll hear from Mr. Smith and then ask if anyone have any questions of the whole panel.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, and I am pleased to say I am now officially the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs with Senate confirmation today. But it is simply a nasty rumor that the two fine senators, Senate President Courtney and Senator Olson, traded their votes in confirmation hearing for my support of Senate Bill 1. That is simply a nasty rumor. And going off of Vice Chair Parrish's comments, the big ticket items for veterans are always going to be, for them and their families, health care, education, and employment, just like for all of our citizens in this great state. But I, you know, and some folks say that this is a symbolic bill, and I recognize that, you know, there's not going to be a huge fiscal on it, but I think it is sometimes more important than we recognize. And I think one of the good unintended consequences that will come out of this bill is a better understanding between our citizens at large and our veterans and military families. So we have about 1% of our population has served in the military in these most recent conflicts. So there is great support across our state for our veterans, but not necessarily the in-depth understanding and connection and understanding what they and their families have gone through in terms of repeated deployments and over a decade of war. And I think this bill helps raise questions of your service in a positive way and allows a dialogue between the employers and the employees to bring that service to the forefront. And I think we'll see good things beyond just a day off for our veterans. And I think it is positive that it is flexible in implementation. It's very achievable, I think, for the business community. So I think those concerns have been taken care of. And I would like to highlight that the motto of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is where every day is Veterans Day. So I plan on taking 365 days off if this bill passes. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panel?
No question, but congratulations, Cameron. You well deserved. We look forward to seeing you here for the next 40 years.
Vice Chair Parrish?
Cameron, I think I just heard you say we should amend this to add spouses, right?
Any other questions or comments? Great. Well, thank you both for coming to express your support.
Thank you.
And unless there's anyone else who wants to be heard on Senate Bill 1, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2034.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2034 authorizes the Office of Emergency Management to coordinate with tribal governments in order to develop proposals and submit applications for federal funding. It would allow OEM to direct federal funding to tribal governments for the purpose of providing emergency program management and emergency services. It defines tribal governments as federally recognized sovereign tribal governments within Oregon or intertribal organizations of two or more federally recognized sovereign tribal governments within Oregon.
Thank you. So the first, the only panel that I have signed up is going to be General Mike Caldwell, Armand Minthorn of the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation, and Ray Denny.
Co-Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marty Plattner. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Management for the Oregon Military Department. House Bill 2034 actually offers the opportunity to align the state of Oregon with the recently passed federal guidelines allowing tribal participation in the federal grant process. Oregon is very unique in its past in that we have already breached that goal on certain categories of grants, specifically in the area of homeland security, but we have not really been able to be as inclusive in the full spectrum of grants that may be offered to the tribes as a part of the federal grant process. What this bill will do is basically align that to allow tribes to not only participate with the emergency management performance grants, but also allow them to compete and to participate with county partners and other neighbors of their sovereign lands in areas of communication and other gaps that are identified in their area. Our office supports this bill, and like I said at the beginning, this aligns it with the recently passed federal statutes that were just passed this past fall. I'll pass it to Mr. Denny.
Thank you, Director Plattner. Chair Fagan, I just want to introduce Armand Minthorn. He's a member of the Board of Trustees.
Can you identify yourself for the record? Thanks.
My name is Ray Denny. I'm the Director of Public Safety for the Confederated Tribes, the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And I'd like to introduce Armand Minthorn. He's a member of the Board of Trustees who will provide our oral comments. Thank you.
Thank you, committee, for this time. The three tribes of Confederate...
Sorry to interrupt. Can you identify yourself for the record?
Armand Minthorn, Umatilla Tribe.
Thank you.
We have three tribes that make up the Confederation, Umatilla, Walla Walla, and Cayuse. We have a reservation of about 172,000 acres. Working through the state tribal public safety cluster, we brought to the attention of the Office of Emergency Management, OEM, our need to be able to apply for the Federal Emergency Management Program grant funds for the purposes of the federal program to sustain and to enhance all hazards emergency management capabilities. An Oregon Attorney General opinion determined tribes are not listed as eligible entities under Oregon Statute 401.305. Federal funds for emergency management are allocated by state to counties and municipalities for emergency management program operations. Tribal governments are not eligible to apply. In 2003, the Department of Homeland Security defined tribes as local governments. While federally recognized tribes maintain a unique federal tribal government-to-government relationship, they do not receive direct EMPG funding from Department of Homeland Security. The CTYR established an independent emergency management program in 2003, covering tribal members and the general public living and working within the reservation. OEM has included a 3.4% tribal set aside in their draft FY 2013 budget based on the population of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. The 3.4% set aside will come out of the state's 20% allocation of the EMPG funds. Therefore, the funds allocated for counties and cities over 85,000 population would not be impacted, except for the final budget that is approved by the federal government for disbursement to states. House Bill 2034 authorizes amendments allowing tribal governments to apply for state negotiated U.S. Department of Homeland Security emergency management funds. It also includes federally recognized Indian tribes to the list of governments eligible to receive emergency management performance grant funds to conduct emergency management programs. We want to thank the Oregon Emergency Management for drafting this legislation and the Governor's Office for introducing this bill to the legislator. We urge the Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness Committee and Oregon legislators to pass House Bill 2034. As a note, Madam Chair, in January of 2013, all of you may recollect the bus crash on Cabbage Hill. 9 fatalities, 31 injuries. Our tribal emergency response people were the first ones there. We were the first ones there. And this is how it is on our reservation. We have major transportation through our reservation, highway and railroad. We have major gas pipelines that go through our reservation, Chevron and Northwest Pipeline. We have transmission utilities, transmission lines that go directly through our reservation. Emergencies don't know any boundaries. Emergencies don't know any color. Therefore, emergencies need to be dealt with directly with the state, with the county, and we can certainly do that. And these funds will help us and strengthen our response time and our capabilities to respond. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panel? Comments? I'll just, since you mentioned that bus crash, I spend quite a bit of time in Echo, Hermiston, and Pendleton because that's where my family lives. And I was in Pendleton on 84 that day, so that was the news of that was incredibly shocking. And so certainly a great appreciation to your tribe and to the emergency management folks for responding.
Thank you.
Great. So there are no other questions. I'll go ahead and did you have one? Go ahead and dismiss this panel. And is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2034? Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2034. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2038.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2038 would repeal 4 provisions of the Oregon Revised Statutes concerning unused or underfunded account structures, ORS 396.365 of Military Department Revolving Fund, ORS 396.366 payments to members of the Oregon National Guard who developed cancer, ORS 396.370 reimbursement for cost of certain hunting licenses, and ORS 399.095 militia unit funds.
Thank you, General Caldwell.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. And before you today, as well indicated by your staff, we have three primarily housekeeping measures that we'd like to take care of. The first portion, I provided you also with a handout, and I think you have it electronically, of those statutes as they're written today. It's a two-pager. Here comes a hard copy, but I think you also have it electronically, thanks to your able staff. The first one is Military Department's revolving loan or revolving fund. So RS 396-350. And this fund was created, I suspect, I didn't do the research, but it's got to be back in the 40s or the 50s, where the department was actually allowed to keep a substantial amount of money, up to $20,000 cash, at the department to take advantage of purchases and other needs that probably in those days things were a little bit different with respect to how we paid our bills. And that cash could be used for travel reimbursement. It could be used, according to the statute, for purchases or other things that the department may have needed. Since the in the induction of computers and certainly a significant amount of modernization in how the state does its business, it's archaic at best. It certainly doesn't, we haven't used it in as many years as I've been there, and that's been a while. Not my over 20-some years, let's put it that way, and more like closer to 30, but nonetheless, today we have things like spots cards and travel cards, and we have all kinds of different mechanisms that are part of the state financial system, so it's all done according to what the Department of Administrative Services rules are, so this statute really has no place in the book, so we think it ought to be just gotten rid of and just get it out of the way. The second portion of the bill, or the second item that is under ORS 396-366. This authorizes the department. This came about several years ago during a lot of publicity was floating around about the hexavalent chromium that was our soldiers were involved with over in Iraq in a water plant. The legislature at the time thought that there was only three, I guess, because they gave us $30,000 and told us to give $10,000 to each one of these folks that had cancer. As it turns out, there's something on the order of 126 soldiers were actually exposed to hexavalent chromium at that plant. 12 filed a federal lawsuit and were awarded $85 million in a civil suit against Kellogg Brown and Root here recently last November. That's still in the courts. It's going to be a while before it gets out. It'll probably end up in the Supreme Court before it's all done. We were certainly not opposed to honoring these soldiers' services. But again, that's all we know about is the 126 that we know that we have records on that were at that plant, which is far short of if $10,000 per soldier is the intent of the legislature, it's going to take a lot more than $30,000. Subsequent to that, the $30,000 was moved on because of budget issues and was never dispensed to any of those folks. So, again, it's on the books. It's sitting there. It puts us at somewhat of a liability. And I think that we need to probably either, one, step up and say we're going to do it for all service members, not just the guardsmen, because there was other active duty service members who may become Oregonians or were Oregonians. We just have no knowledge of it. So I think it's a big liability, and we would like to see it removed. ORS 396-370 authorized, again, the legislature formed this, which we thought was a good idea back in 2007. I think the initial, as I recall, and I'm looking at Representative Escobar, who I think probably remembers those hearings, the initial idea was to have a service member or a veteran show up with a 214 or an ID card and get a hunting and fishing license. That was the initial intent. As the bill moved through the session and as people testified on it, particularly the ODF&W, became apparent that that was going to be very difficult for them to do for a host of different reasons, and I don't want to rehash that debate, but I remember there was a good deal of frustration during that whole period. Nonetheless, the bill was passed. We were given in the 2000, I guess it was 2005, so it has been a while, $196,000. And again, in 2007, we were appropriated $22,000 to pay the Department of Fish and Wildlife for people who had gotten hunting and fishing licenses and then would submit to us at the military department a copy of that receipt that they had that license, and then we would reimburse them in a check, which is not very efficient, I must admit, but nevertheless it worked until money got tight and all of a sudden that money went away, so it sits there without any funding. Again, we still get requests, but we are not able to fund it. We don't have any appropriated money to do that. The last one is the Militia Unit Fund, which is, again, goes back probably in the 50s at best. When I first joined the Oregon National Guard a long, long time ago, we actually had the bill requires that the local unit would have a checking account, and they would keep a checkbook. And that checkbook, again, in those days, we used it to pay for copying, believe it or not, because we didn't have any copiers. So we'd actually go down to a local attorney's office, and every month we would get a bill for, I think it was a nickel a copy, and we were very judicious because the nickels added up quickly. And then we would write a check out of that checkbook and then give that, and then once a quarter, every 6 months, I don't recall, the bank account would have to be audited at the military department. All this was sent in and audited at the military department. As we progressed in our ability to do business and certainly fall within the accounting rules and the payment rules of the state and the federal government, that became something that was just unworkable. And we were cited in several audits that this was very dangerous practice and that we ought to stop it. So we did. And I think we stopped it in about 1991, 92, something like that. So that, again, has not been used for almost 20 years. So we're thinking this is a good time just to get it off the books and get it out of here. So that pretty much concludes my testimony on this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments of General Caldwell? Representative Escobar?
General, you stated that you'd been around this process about 30 years. That means the last time I asked how old you were, you said you're 39, so you joined when you were 9?
Yes, sir. That's it. Yeah. Madam Chairman, Representative Escobar, I'm like Jack Benny. You know, I appreciate it. Of course, Chair, you probably don't remember that name, but the joke was, he said, well, why haven't you got married? And he said, I promised my mother I wouldn't marry till I was 40. So he kept that going for about 40 years. So I'm pretty close to that, Mr. Representative.
Any other comments or questions? Great. Well, thank you, General Caldwell.
Want me to stay here for the next one?
Yeah. Are there any other folks who'd like to testify on House Bill 2038? Okay, if not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2038, and then I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2083.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2083 allows active service members to suspend telecommunication services, internet services, health spa services, and health club exercise or athletic activities via written notice of suspension to service providers. It requires service members to provide proof of official orders showing active status with written notice of suspension to the service provider. It permits proof of active service to be provided within 90 days of written notice if delay was prompted by military necessity or other reasonable circumstances. It also makes the suspension effective upon the date notice was given. It authorizes service members to reinstate suspended services on the same terms and conditions if they're no longer in active service, and provide written notice to the service provider within 90 days after the termination of their active service. It then requires the service provider to reinstate that service member under the same or substantially similar services within 30 days of receiving written notice of reinstatement. It prohibits the service providers from charging penalties, fees, lost deposits, or other costs to service members for suspending or reinstating services, and it prohibits service members from being liable for payment of services during the period of their suspension.
Thank you. General Caldwell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. In your packet, or your staff has probably already provided you a letter from Captain Tony Garcia, who's actually one of our Judge Advocate General lawyers, and he's unfortunately not here today. This is his brainchild, actually, because he does a lot of work with our service members in trying to help them negotiate certain things that occur to them when they transition from traditional National Guard service into federal service. The history of this is basically based on the Service Member Civil Relief Act, which was first created in 1918 and expired and was resurrected in 1940 with some significant amendments and broadening the protection. And it was also modified again in 1991 and again in 2003 on the federal level. The SCRA restricts or limits actions against service members in areas of financial management, such as rental agreements, security deposits, evictions, installments, contracts, credit card, interest rates, mortgages, civil judicial proceedings, income tax payments, and several other areas. Those are the highlights. The legislature here in Oregon in 2009 expanded redress by allowing Oregon courts in the venues minimum fines and also awarding attorney fees. We found that very helpful, and I think the history will point out that many of these violations were occurring with different entities, particularly in the electronic era that we live, and you can't go down to the local person. You've got to get online. You've got to do all these different things. And the old days, you could walk down to the bank and get eyeball to eyeball with somebody. It's pretty difficult to do these days. So many of these things were happening, but there was really no redress for the individual service member. When Oregon created that piece, which was significant, and the first one in the country, I might add, to add the attorney fees into the local attorney, it suddenly made everybody with a law license in Oregon an advocate for the Service Member Civil Relief Act, which was a huge, huge step. And since that time, since 2009, the incidents that we've seen have dropped off absolutely dramatically. Nonetheless, this was an area that is not covered under the SCRA, and dozens of Oregon soldiers have had issues primarily, believe it or not, with gyms, health clubs, spas, that sort of thing, and a few in the internet and the cable provider folks, but that's probably the smaller majority. They had cancellation fees, suspension fees, continuation of payments, even with, you know, no uses while they're in Iraq or Afghanistan. They've also been sent to collection when they were overseas, which screwed up their credit and caused them problems. It's our belief that service members need to have a smooth transition into federal service. It's difficult enough when you're leaving your home, your family, and your job, if you've got one, to serve your country in a relatively short order. We're much better today than we were back in the mid-2000s. We're giving people almost a year notice of deployments. But occasionally it happens that it's shorter than that. Very rarely, but it does happen. So our objective is to make sure that we can get these folks into federal service with no hassle, at least a bit of hassle as we can, and adding some protection so we can actually have these folks not be badgered after the fact and also end up with with credit problems. I think Tony's letter, or Captain Garcia's letter, which you have in your packet, really does address some of the finer points that he's dealt with respect to being a judge advocate general in our organization. And I'd ask you to read it, but it's pretty much what I've just told you. And again, I think this is a small number of folks. This is not a large problem, but it is a problem on occasion. Excuse me. And typically, we have a service member who's ignorant, thinks they're under SCRA coverage, and they're not. So we brought this for you today to discuss and debate in hopes that we can broaden that out to make sure we cover some of these areas that we just didn't get in the last time we did this in 2009. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Well, I'll just say that as someone who once had to attempt to get out of a 24-hour fitness, because as it turns out, they expected me to spend more than 24 hours in a year there trying to get out of that. Those are tough contracts to get out of. So I think this is a very common sense bill, and I appreciate you bringing your testimony forward. There's anyone else who'd like to testify on? Oh, actually, there are a couple others. So I'm going to go ahead and be dismissed.
Thank you.
And I'll call for another panel of Brant Wolf and Mike Dewey. Whoever wants to, whoever wants to start can, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Vice Chair Fagan, members of the committee. I'm Brant Wolf with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA represents the landline telecommunications carriers that operate throughout the state. We're not opposed to House Bill 2803, but we do have some concern, well, a couple of issues that we'd like to flesh out with the military department before we officially moved to a neutral position. There are some concerns about some of the language, just some wording that I can either go into some detail with you all if you'd like to hear it or not, but I just wanted to go on the record as saying that we have some things we'd like to talk to the military department about, and if necessary, work together with the military department on some possibly friendly amendment language if we needed to do that. That's all I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thanks. I think we'll hear from
Thank
Mr.
you.
Madam Vice Chair, Mike Dewey for the record, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. We are the largest provider of internet and video services. Most of the contracts are a bundle of services, video, telephone, and internet. We support the concept of this bill. We think it makes sense. We just want to make it work in the sense that it's fairly, if you look at it, a little bit open-ended, so I would agree with my colleague here that it would be better to flush out some of the verbiage, but I think we can do that. We just want to make sure everybody knows how to make it work, they're contacting the right person, that sort of situation. So we think it's a good idea. We appreciate those that serve our country, and we want to help them as best we can. And at the end of the day, it's not going to make a difference on the bottom line, so we need to figure out a way to help them out on this. Thank you.
Are there any questions or comments? Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to drag you guys into the weeds too much, but maybe just highlight a little bit of the concerns. Is it when they come back from deployment?
Sure.
Is that kind of where the hang-up on the language is right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, yeah, it's specifically, and this might seem, it might seem like a distinction without a difference, but the use of the word suspend service versus disconnect service, that might make a difference to some of our members and how they come back and forth into service. Suspension means one thing, disconnect means another thing. And then also, as far as a contract goes, whether or not a provider would be expected to have that person go right back into the middle of that contract and serve out that contract as it is, or if things have changed, if rates have changed, things of that nature, if that needed to be updated or not. I mean, just things like that that need to be just talked about at least. I'm not sure that's even those things even matter or not, but if they do, we need to figure it out.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I guess the bill has me a little bit confused because what federal law already governs a lot of this. Mm-hmm. And so how do you respond to what the feds are already asking all of you who have services with military? And I say that because when, you know, my husband deployed, our credit cards, you know, there's laws around, you know, credit card interest rate that's being charged. There's laws around shutoff. There's laws around, you know, you can break a lease. You can do all kinds of things, and federal government already does this. So how do you respond to what the feds are already asking you to do? And that begs my second question, which is probably not a question for you, but maybe for our folks in the back, is the need for a bill when the feds have dialed this in so well. And maybe I'm missing something, but in my experiences, watching people deploy, coming back and forth, and PCSing, we've PCSed across the country before, I'm just kind of not sure what the need is and how you're not already meeting the need.
May I, Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I'm not an expert on the federal act. My understanding is what I heard, this expands it a bit. And so that's what I heard. I could be wrong, but that's what I heard. So from that perspective, we want to, if we can get it closely aligned verbiage-wise with the federal act, if we're expanding it. But it's always nice to have a state law to look at, too. So I don't quarrel with that. Often I go the other way. But with this situation, I think it's a little bit different for somebody that has to move quickly. But that's what I heard. Now, I could be off on that.
And I'll just kind of follow up.
Yes.
I'm just, you know, I'm looking at the types of providers who were asking to make exception. And, you know, we belong to Cub Sport in Tualatin. When my husband deployed, they were very quick to reallocate our share of. I mean, so I guess I'm kind of curious what's driving it and what you're not already doing, because most of the telecommunications providers and things during our deployment were quite gracious about being supportive already. So I just want to get that on the record.
If I may, and this is a double-edged sword. We appreciate that this would not be a violation, for example, of the uniform UTPA. So we're very happy we don't have penalties in here, and so we can work through this. And I do think your
local cable company is going to work with people that have been deployed. They understand that. This provides a little bit more information, but we do appreciate there aren't any penalties here, and let's see how it works if we decide to move in the direction of passing a bill.
Thank you.
I think that Representative Parrish was excused during part of General Caldwell's testimony because he was mentioning how this stuff is not stuff that's currently covered under the Civil Service Act. So I didn't know if you wanted to come back, General Caldwell, and address Representative Parrish's question.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you, guys.
We're moving faster today than you would.
I'm bringing my gun, big gun up.
Oh, there you go.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. A couple things. One, as we were feverishly looking in the back for the SCRA, we did find, or Cameron found, that most of it is covered. I think it's pretty much covered within the SCRA most every instance. The difference is, again, back in 2009, we changed it, made it a state law to try to connect with the SCRA, because what we found was a whole lot of service members would have these. They were so numerous that you're asking the federal attorney out of Portland to pick up somebody's canceled credit card or service or telephone service. They just didn't do it. They simply didn't do it. So legislature decided to try to adopt language in our state SCRA, if you want to call it that, and also put the attorneys who would actually get attorney fees if they were found to be successful. And that engaged everybody in the state who's an attorney who wants to help a service member. They could do it and not have to do it pro bono, was really what it boiled down to. So that's one of the issues. The I think the issue that the two previous folks testified to, this particular language doesn't specifically state cancellation, as I think Mike indicated. There is no obligation for the service member to reinstate service under this act. If it was to go as it is, it says it may reinstate service as opposed to cancel. Now, that might be something that the industry would prefer, is to say cancel it, which in that case would probably be not a bad amendment. Certainly would work, and that would cut off the string of payments while this member happens to be in Afghanistan or some other place. So that might be something we'd want to consider and work with the folks on, and certainly look for an amendment perhaps. And I'll turn it to Cameron real quick and let him.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Director of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. So at least on the wireless and mobile phone contracts, it is covered under the federal SCRA Section 535 Alpha. When deployed for 90 days or longer, or when permanently transferred, if change of duty results in an inability to use the service and inability to satisfy the terms of the contract, that's when you can either cancel or suspend or cancel your contract. And I think it comes down to less about enforcement in kind of engaging the legal community as well as the BOLI commissioner and the attorney general. Often it's more about education, both for the service members to know what they have eligible and the business community, whether it's an employment issue coming back and forth or the contracts. So it kind of engages our state. Having it mirror the federal statutes help engage our state actors as an advocate for our veterans and military families. And I think it's less about the stick and more about education, because the business community and the employers are often on the ball, ready to respond when kind of mediated between.
And again, I'll just reiterate, probably 95% of the issues we've had have not been with telecommunication providers, TV, internet, any of that. That's one in a rare one. Most of them are dealing with health clubs and other spas and other things that people get themselves into while they're in their normal civilian life, and then they have to leave, and then they have these onerous fines and penalties, and they just don't want to play ball with these service members. So I can't recall, and I've noticed in Tony's letter, there hasn't been one relative to one of these telecommunications issues. So I think they have been excellent corporate partners in helping with this effort. But these other folks, I think, again, it's ignorance, as Cameron has indicated, have been the majority of what we have seen with our soldiers.
Great. Any other questions or comments? Did you want to?
Nope, that's it.
Great. Well, thank you for coming back up.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 2083? not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2083. And that concludes all the public hearings we have for today, but we do have one just matter of courtesy. If Bill Buck would like to come up, he has been serving in Representative Parrish's office as an intern, and I will go ahead and hand it over to Representative Parrish to engage with him.
Well, I think he just wanted to basically address our committee. He's been pretty faithfully being down here as part of his internship and paying attention to what's going on down here. So just got to introduce yourself. And
okay. Vice Chair Fagan and Vice Chair Parrish, my name is Bill Buck, private citizen living in Portland, retired educator. I've had the privilege to serve with Representative Parrish the last 6 weeks on a PCC consortium that's been down here. I'm down here 2 days a week. I'm visually disabled on Social Security disability. Thank you for your patience in that area. You may have seen me here. I try to come to the committee, both the Senate and the House veterans, during my 6 weeks here. And I basically want to say thank you. I am very impressed how I've heard each one of you compassion and passion for veterans. This is a huge matter for me. I have three nephews that served in the Middle East during the past 10 years. And then a senior member of the Greatest Generation in my family passed away February 25th, 2013. George Buck from Beardstown, Illinois, served in the Pacific at Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima during World War II and was among the brave people that served so people of my generation could live like kings. Despite serving on Iwo Jima, George Buck had a sense of humor. One time, during his later years, he would actually talk with me about it when I'd go back and visit him. And he said one time his buddy got shot during, of course, we all know this is some of the most fierce fighting American forces have been involved with in our 200-year-plus existence as a nation. And as he took his buddy back down to the nurse's station on the beach, he thought, well, there goes that guy. And 1 year later, he got a wedding invitation because his buddy was ended up marrying the nurse who helped him down on the beach. Another part of my family, Ralph Buck, my father, who lies on the green grass of Willamette National Cemetery, did not experience his war effort as successfully as his brother George. My father took his own life in 1998 after having 50 years of nightmares, and he incurred those through hunting German submarines off the coast of Florida, and at the end of the war he was on Okinawa ready for that possible horrible invasion of Japan. Each piece of legislation that you've talked about during the last several weeks would have helped my father. And he was part of that generation where you didn't talk too much. And I heard him and my uncle talking about nobody ever offered them help from their post-traumatic experiences. But I thank you because your passion and compassion on this huge variety of veterans issues that both you and the Senate Veterans Committee care about and advocate for and have a passion for. On another note, I want to express my gratitude to Representative Parrish. Frankly, I did not know legislators like this still existed in the state of Oregon. I never hear her tell a different answer to the same question during the day. I see her treat, whether it's the presidents of Portland Community College or senior citizens concerned about issues with manufactured housing, with equal respect. And it's and I don't say this in a silly way, it's kind of an eye-opener for the blind man. And also appreciate the candor and the dignity that she helps herself with. Even though she's young enough to be my daughter, I already have three children, but I would certainly be proud to have her as my daughter. So, again, thank you very much for your service. I am very impressed that our legislature is continuing to function and truly be a citizen legislature. So thank you. If there's any questions?
I just have to say, the program at PCC that brought us interns this session for this quarter, funded, I believe, out of some of their foundational money. They really wanted to give students the experience to come down here, be hands-on. To Bill's point, it wasn't just 20-somethings. They were very thoughtful about who they selected. And I'm just honored that they actually got to kind of pick who they wanted to serve for. And Bill picked me, so I'm thrilled to have been chosen by him. And it's been a great experience. And encourage you to keep coming to the Capitol.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I answer that?
Yeah, of course.
It was a perfect set up being with Representative Parrish for me, and her values and her consistency and her patriotism were a perfect match for me. And I am not a typical PCC student anymore, older, disabled white guy, you know. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate this program that we were allowed to apply for. And this is my last week, but I will certainly miss being down here. Thanks for that experience.
Thank you very much. Thank you for Representative Parrish for sharing it with us. Any comments, Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest to everyone that if you know someone from the World War II era, to get those stories down and get that information down, because we're losing those people very rapidly, and there's just so many stories that they not only were witness history, they were history. And it's just amazing to me of that generation of how there's so many different types of stories. I just learned one the other day that my father-in-law, who was fought in the Battle of Britain before the United States got in the war, ended up being General Doolittle's personal pilot. Well, General Doolittle's granddaughter just called him to talk to him. She wanted to know if he was authentic. So she said, "Tell me something about my grandfather." Mm. He said, "Well, one time in France," he said, "I remember I turned around and there was General Doolittle walking on his hands up in the airplane." And she went, "You're authentic." Because he'd shared that with her. So get those stories down, because those people were really something else.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, if there's anything, is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. Well, I'll gavel out the committee on House Services, Veteran Services, and Emergency Preparedness.